Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Freedom of privacy and freedom of speech are two issues a lot of us are talking about these days, one in connection with ongoing plans to put police drones in the skies over St. Louis, the other concerning what we can and cannot put on our license plates. And speaking of speech, lawyers for baseball sluggers Albert Pujols and Jack Clark are slugging it out in verbal support for their clients. And when it comes to cyberbullying, is it being taken seriously enough by prosecutors? We'll ask St. Louis Circuit Attorney Jennifer Joyce, one of our legal panelists on today's Legal Roundtable program. Also with us, as usual, attorneys Mark Smith, Assistant Vice Chancellor at Washington University, where he also directs the Career Center, and Bill Freivogel, director, of the School of Journalism at SIU in Carbondale. Nice to see you all again. Jennifer, thanks for being with us once more.
My pleasure.
Let me start with you. As you know, last week was the anniversary of the suicide of Megan Meyer, the young girl who was the victim of online bullying. Her mom was on our program. She expressed some concern, Jennifer, about prosecutors and judges not being aggressive enough in dealing with cyberbullying issues. What she says basically is that kids have caught on to this, so there's no incentive for them not to do this online bullying. Let's take a quick listen to what Tina Meyer had to say, and we'll go from there.
At the end of the day, we have to start prosecuting, because I just sat there in a training 2 weeks ago with 20 different police departments. I asked each one of them, have you filed? There are school resource officers. Have you filed these issues? Have any of have any of these gotten past the prosecuting attorney's desk? None. None of them. And these had all gotten to a point where they had to subpoena records. They've got families who are distraught, kids who have moved out of school, who have attempted, you name it, because of cyberbullying situations. They show that it's been repeated, and it does not get past the prosecuting attorney's desk. And it's frustrating on all fronts. And that's where I think that it's really getting the prosecuting attorneys and the judges together and the police departments to try to figure out what are the best ways to handle this? How do we handle it? And I think it's really learning from each other. But at the end of the day, they have to be taken seriously.
That's Tina Meyer. She appeared on our program last week. And I think it's self-explanatory what she had to say with regard to prosecution. What do you think, Jennifer Joyce?
Well, I listened to Ms. Meyer when she was on your show. Actually, I happened to be in my car, and it's such a tragic anniversary, and my heart goes out to her. It's difficult for me, though, to comment specifically on what she's talking about if I don't know what jurisdiction she's referring to. I'm the prosecutor for the city of St. Louis, so I can tell you in my jurisdiction, we have not had a case brought to us by the police where a adult has harassed a child. It's possible that there are cases where a child harasses another child. Those cases would go to juvenile court, not my jurisdiction. And so I'm not aware of the volume of cases that are being prosecuted there. But I will say that it's important that we continue to keep this issue in the forefront. And through the Megan Meyer Foundation, I know she's trying to do that. I think the more we educate parents and teachers and police and prosecutors and judges, the more we're able to make a difference in this area.
It's interesting that she pointed out in another part of the program that the kids seem to catch on very quickly when there is, you know, aggressive prosecution or when it's handled at that level.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And that would be handled at the juvenile court level. So it would be interesting to see those numbers.
Different jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Bill, you look like you were getting ready to weigh in.
I was just going to say, I mean, it's impossible not to feel really sad about the Megan Meyer tragedy and to have a lot of respect for what her mom is doing to try to educate people about the problems. I would just inject one note of caution that I think it's you have to be pretty careful in the way you go about criminalizing nasty things that kids say to each other. Of course, in the case, the Meyer case, it wasn't a kid, but a lot of these are one kid to another kid. And the Missouri Supreme Court, as a matter of fact, threw out one provision of the cyber bullying law that the Missouri legislature passed, saying that it was a violation of free speech. That part just had made it a crime to repeatedly say something to another person that was upsetting to them. So that's totally out. Then the other provision the Missouri Supreme Court said could only be enforced if it were enforced very narrowly, to only apply to something that is the equivalent of what is referred to as fighting words, something that causes might cause an immediate kind of retaliatory response, or just causes really serious emotional emotional reaction. So, and actually, there have hardly ever been any prosecutions for fighting words. So the notion of turning that we should see a lot of criminal cases against kids who are engaging in cyberbullying, I think is one we have to sort of examine.
You say it's basically one-on-one, generally one-on-one involving youngsters. But the case in Florida, which came to light last week, as many as 15 kids may have ganged up on this young lady who ultimately killed herself.
No, I agree. I agree that it oftentimes would not be one-on-one. There was a number of kids who were involved, two principally it looked like, and then a larger group of about 14. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that when these kinds of things occur online, they oftentimes are, you know, a sort of a group of people who know each other and are insulting each other.
Mark, it brings to mind something we have talked about before, and that is that this whole online world, this whole cyber world, really requires a whole new set of laws in
many
cases, because it's just so different and creates so many different challenges.
And it's so easy to do it anonymously. We wrestle with the same issue at the university, you know, trying to say, well, what are the... You know, you want to have a welcoming place where you still have a free exchange of ideas, but we want people to be nice to each other. And so you have these aspirational goals, which we set very high, but then we have the minimum standards, what you can get in trouble for. But there's a big gap in between where we want our students to be and where they'll, you know, always act. And it's very difficult. And, I mean, I think there's a little bit of that in this, too. And like everyone said, this is a horrible situation. But I think a lot of times this bullying comes out and people don't know necessarily where it's coming from. I guess you can try and track it down, but it's still very difficult to track down.
We had an email question in conjunction with this, in which the emailer said, is there any recourse against people who post things online that are not true? Is there?
Well, you can sue the person who posts it. We've talked before about how, though, the website on which it is posted has absolute immunity from legal consequences. And so, but you can, if you can figure out who the person was, and it's false, you can sue them. And if you can't figure out if it's an anonymous posting, you can go to court and ask the court to reveal the name of the anonymous poster, and they will do that sometimes, and other times they won't.
But oftentimes that'll just tell you what computer it came from.
Right.
So you don't know who was using the computer.
Who actually typed in the words is the issue.
Yeah. Is this creating any problems for you as a prosecutor in general, Jennifer Joyce, in the terms of the online world and the things that transpire there?
I would say it creates more opportunity in law enforcement than problems. You know, we get a lot of information in our investigations from people posting things online, bragging about what they did. And, you know, that's pretty common now to use as evidence in court.
On the other hand, there's a lot of fraud that is perpetrated online as
true,
well.
True, a lot of identity theft and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. We have a special fraud section in my office, and, you know, even something like the rollout of Obamacare, you know, anytime something new happens like that, people just get bombarded with email solicitations trying to rip them off.
Yeah. While we're on the subject of cyberbullying, I want to just raise the issue of this case in Maryville, Missouri. The young lady there who says that she was raped, and apparently there is a cell phone video suggesting, in fact, that that was the case. She says that she is now being harassed online and the victim of cyberbullying. No charges were brought against the high school football star who she accused of this sexual assault. The prosecutor there decided not to prosecute. Apparently, he is rethinking that now. The attorney general has been asked to come into it. Not going to happen, from what I understand. Now he is asking for a special prosecutor. And I think, Jennifer, you might have even been approached on that. Is that
right.
correct?
A lot of prosecutors around Missouri. A call went out last week. in an attempt to gather a list of experienced prosecutors who would take a fresh look at this as a special prosecutor. And my initial reaction was absolutely. And then when I sat down with my chief trial staff and we looked at the math as to how far away this was, and we realized we didn't have the manpower to cover it. But there's other prosecutors around the state who have volunteered to be on the list and be appointed as a special in this case. And I expect that to be announced pretty soon.
Why would a special prosecutor be necessary? Why can't the prosecutor who turned down charges the first time revisit that and press charges?
Well, I think he could do that, but I think that he probably made the judgment that there's been such media attention to this case that it was probably in everybody's best interest to just bring in a fresh set of eyes. We were talking a little bit earlier in the green room, and the dilemma that prosecutor has is he probably has a lot of information about this case, which affects the prosecutorial merits of the case that he's not at liberty to discuss publicly. And, he doesn't want to do that because it's unethical and because it would jeopardize the future of that investigation. And so he's kind of got to stand there pretty silent with people making all kinds of allegations about him, be they true or not. I don't know. I don't know him. He probably thinks the best way to resolve this issue finally and completely is to have another fresh set of eyes look at it.
You know, there was this claim by the alleged victim's family, and then some suggestions, I think, also in the news reports that because the alleged rapist was from an influential political family, that could have affected the prosecutorial decision. So I think maybe by asking for a special prosecutor, that would address any kind of question of that sort. You know, the other way in which technology comes to play in this case is that group Anonymous that can, take down people's websites and was very involved in a similar, at least a somewhat similar case in Steubenville, Ohio, turned their attention to this case and, took down the sheriff's online capabilities.
This has got a lot of ingredients, made for TV series, I think. The family, their house was burned down in Maryville. Mm-hmm. They were forced to move out because of hostility in town, from what I understand. It's got a lot of ingredients.
I would just caution everybody, though, we don't know the real facts of this case. There's a lot of stuff out in the media. A lot of people have strong opinions, but the full factual basis of this case is not out yet.
Well, let's leave it at that for this segment. We'll come back and talk about any number of other things that are on our agenda for today. This is our Legal Roundtable Day, and with me in studio is St. Louis Circuit Attorney Jennifer Joyce. Bill Freivogel is with us from SIU in Carbondale, and Mark Smith from Washington University. Back to continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our Legal Roundtable. With me in studio, Bill Freivogel, Director of the School of Journalism at SIU in Carbondale, Mark Smith, Associate Vice Chancellor at Washington University and Director of the Career Center there, and Jennifer Joyce is Circuit Attorney in the city of St. Louis. Okay, in the city of St. Louis, our police chief is once again taking a closer look at the possibility of putting drones in the air for surveillance purposes. He himself has expressed some concern that there are some privacy issues here. Mark, is that an issue, do you think?
I think it could be an issue, but I think it's a good idea. I mean, part of the problem with the helicopter, the effectiveness for chases, is you got to have the helicopter up in the air. And, I think the police department has one pilot, or do they have more than that now?
They work with St. Louis County and St. Charles County. They pool those expenses.
Good. That's what we were talking about that when I was on the board. I thought it was a great idea because you got to have it up in the air to be meaningful. And so a drone, you could get up quickly. And I think people are thinking, well, that means you're going to have drones up monitoring neighborhoods. And I don't think anyone's talking about that. I think he has talked about for high security events like a World Series or something, having drones to supplement the police manpower. But I just remember from my short interaction with the police department, these chases are really dangerous to police and to just innocent citizens who happen to be walking down the street or driving. And if there's any way we can chase the bad guys without them knowing and then send police in, I think that's a great thing.
So you don't see a privacy concern.
If it was used for, but I think you can limit it to what you want. And I think I trust that people like the public safety director who now oversees the police department, people like Jennifer Joyce and others and the regular citizens will say this is going too far if they try to do something like that.
Hey, they can put a drone right over my house. I'm good. The fact of the matter is we don't have any privacy now anyway. You know, this in no way diminishes our level of privacy, having drones flying around. There's surveillance cameras everywhere. And maybe because I'm in law enforcement, I have a friendlier attitude toward it. But I think Mark's point is the most compelling one to me. I mean, I personally have seen at least two officers killed all kinds of innocent civilians injured and killed. And this would just give the police a more effective and considerably cheaper way to hold bad guys accountable that are terrorizing our city. I have absolutely no problem. I'm an enthusiastic supporter of this idea.
And as the chief has said, you know, these are not going to be drones that are like hovering outside your bedroom window or anything. They're not going to have hellfire missiles on them. They're not going to be – I don't think they're going to have any kind of weaponry.
No, unmanned, unarmed.
They're a lot less expensive than a helicopter.
Yeah.
And as both Mark and Jennifer have said, the list of – if you put together the list of people who have been killed in these police chases over years, it's really a tragic and long list.
I think this morning there was an article in ProPublica I saw online where they said that the phenomenon was the D word. Because if you call it a drone, people freak out. And just because it's called a drone, and they associate that with, stuff going on in Pakistan.
But I would have a problem if they were started sending drones up, the police department, and just patrolling neighborhoods with drones, looking in yards. Oh, this guy's got, marijuana plants growing, and we send him. I would have a problem with that.
Don't grow marijuana.
Well, I know. And
Mark,
I don't.
We
I can't even grow tomatoes. Yeah, I can't even grow tomatoes. So I don't think I could do the marijuana plants. But I would have a problem with that. And I think if one of these drones was hovering outside a window looking into a house, I think any place where you have a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Right.
But I think what Jennifer said is exactly right. On the streets, there are so many cameras already. I don't think we have a reasonable expectation of privacy there. But I have I don't want them looking in my yard or other people's yards. I don't want them looking in houses, private areas like that.
I would like them to see somebody breaking into my garage at 3 o'clock in the morning, So I re-extend my invitation. You can put the drone right over my house.
I mean, I think where you could end up with something getting a little more, even more controversial, though, is if let's say you have decided as a law enforcement technique that you're going to really put a lot of law enforcement efforts in one particular area where there have been a lot of, say, murders. Mm-hmm. And so do you have the drone there, at all times? I mean, maybe you do.
Yeah.
But the neighborhood then could begin to think, well, we're being, targeted for this kind of surveillance. And you could see pushback.
We're policing that way now in the city of St. Louis.
Yeah, flooding with all the cameras.
Flooding high crime areas with
police
officers.
Right, College Hill.
Yeah. Did I dream this or did I – maybe the chief indicated that this might be put to a public vote. Is that something that I just
– I did not see that. But what I did see that I thought was a fantastic idea is that they're planning on having a city information center, some kind of a coordinated law enforcement monitoring of all these different security cameras that are all over the city, like Antonio French has his. And, they're everywhere, but nobody's really watching them. And so he's talking about having a city information center. I think that's a fantastic idea. I did not hear about him putting this to a vote.
I may have literally dreamed that. I don't know, for some reason. At this stage of my life,
you got to get more exciting dreams, Don.
That's about as exciting as it gets. And even that is wrong. So there we go. Okay, while we're talking about traffic, there's another very interesting story I hope you guys picked up on concerning the suit against the director of Department of Revenue, which was concerned because a citizen who was apparently a Kansas Jayhawks fan has a license plate which reads MZU SUX, and you don't have to wander very far from that to come up with Mizzou sucks is the way many people would read that. The Revenue Department called it obscene, but this gentleman with a license plate, who happens to be an attorney, won the case. What do you make of that? I mean, how far can we go, do you think, on what we put on our license plates, Bill?
Well, the court said that, this attorney appealed to an administrative board. An administrative board reviewed whether or not this message was obscene, using the Supreme Court standards about contemporary community values, et cetera. They looked up looked it up in Webster's Dictionary, which says it means it can mean, in addition to maybe other meanings that we might impart to it, it can mean subpar or inadequate. And so, subpar and inadequate, that's not obscene. So this is not an obscene message, and therefore it's permitted. And then there was an appeal by the I guess it was a state appellate court, which said we're not going to second guess the administrative body's determination that this was not obscene.
Do we have any Mizzou grads at the table here?
No. But I'm sure there were a lot on the Western District Court of Appeals, though.
Yeah.
Well, so be it then. The case has been won. There's another. The Department of Revenue is fighting another case, which just came up this morning. I saw it in the Business Journal. The Department of Revenue is fighting Ameren, responding to Schnucks, seeking a refund for energy used in making donuts and cakes and various pastries. Have you heard about that?
No.
This is something we'll have to look into for another program, but apparently there is some sort of a refund. You can claim a tax-exempt situation for what is called processing. And they're claiming that Schnucks is processing food, therefore is eligible for this refund. Looks a little too complicated for four people who don't really know much about it beyond that. But we'll take a look at that. Okay, now to Albert Pujols and Jack Clark. Mark, I'm going to turn to you on this because you're the one that was distributing this letter that Jack Clark's attorney here in St. Louis sent to his counterpart for Albert Pujols in Los Angeles. Four pages. A very interesting letter indeed. There are a lot of attempts at humor at that, some of which I know fell flat in Los Angeles. Tell us about this letter. What do you think of it?
Well, so this was a letter that Albert Watkins, who is, I guess, along with I'm blanking on his name now.
Chet
Pleben, right, is representing Jack Clark. And so it made the email circuit among lawyers, I think, and so I sent it to you guys. And so I think basically he's proposed, and this has made the press, lie detector tests, dueling lie detector tests, and like you said, there's some attempts at humor. I think, we discussed this before. I think Mr. Pujols has a pretty weak case just because the law is – it's very difficult to prove a defamation claim. And so what they're doing, I think, by this letter is making a very clear – we're going to depose you under oath. These are all the kinds of questions we're going to be asking about performance-enhancing drugs, legal and non-legal, what you may have done when you were a teenager in the Dominican Republic where maybe these things are around more, and do you really want to go through all that? And that's kind of what we talked about before, too. I think, that's the big thing. You're going to have to testify under oath about anything they want to ask you pretty much, and do you really want to do that?
Among other things, he pointed out that Viagra is a performance-enhancing
drug. Along with Ben
Gay.
That's
right. That's the kind of tone that this letter was taking. But Jennifer Joyce, a polygraph is certainly not admissible in court.
No, it's not. And, it's kind of a silly thing to offer in that letter, in my opinion. We use polygraphs as an investigative tool, but they're not admissible in court because they're not considered to be sufficiently reliable to be considered as evidence by a judge or a jury. So to think that you could settle something based on a polygraph
I don't think he really thought they were going to do this. I think this was more,
I'm
going to be talking, but
what I'm
really doing is between the lines saying, I'm going to be your worst nightmare in a deposition.
Right.
I'm a loose cannon, and I'm going to ask you all these outrageous questions, and do you want to really go through that?
It's a threat. Yeah. It's a threat.
The L.A. attorney responded by saying the proposal is absolutely absurd.
Yeah.
Absurd. Any thoughts on it, Bill?
Well, I think if Jack Clark really has confidence in himself that he should challenge him to a home run derby. although I agree with Mark that maybe it wasn't the smartest thing to file this lawsuit. I wouldn't go so far as to say he's got a weak case. I mean, he's got a high burden of proof, Pujols does, but I wouldn't say it's a weak case. Joe Martino and Hessel, are very very accomplished lawyers who would be very tough on this kind of a case. But he would have to show that it was actual malice on right. Clark's part, reckless disregard for the truth, stated with knowledge that it was false. So it's because Pujols is definitely a public figure, there would be that high burden of proof.
Is this a typical approach amongst attorneys to kind of in letters like this or communications of any sort, basically trying to offset the opposition this way?
I hope not.
Yeah. I mean, occasionally you would put like a footnote or something that you would show the other lawyers in the office, wasn't that stinging, but you couldn't even get it half the time because it's kind of not the way things done. And you don't want to make it personal. This is business. It's the law, and we're kind of representing the profession, and so we should conduct ourselves a certain way. I mean, that's what I think. And I think also, well, I don't think anything he did is probably an ethical violation, although I didn't comb through it. Once you start doing this, you're in a dangerous area. So there was somebody who got in trouble. Was it Buzz Westfall for criticizing a judge or something?
Yes, he said he was intellectually dishonest.
Yeah, and you can't criticize judges that way. And so I just think it's dangerous to start going down that path.
I'm just reminded, by the way, that not everybody may be familiar with the source of the problem here between these two ex-ball players. One's an ex-ball player and the other one is a hurt ball player.
Yeah.
But Jack Clark apparently said on a local radio program that he has solid information that Albert was guilty of juicing, as he put it.
He said, I know for a fact he was, and that he and they talked that he has been a juicer. That was, and so then you get into lawyer stuff like, well, what do you mean by
Jack
juicer?
LaLanne,
yeah,
juicer?
Jack, and that was one of the things in Watkins' letter.
That was cited in the letter.
You mean,
what is it?
Drinking carrot juice? And that's what lawyers are good at. And it's just like Bill Clinton when he tried to dissect, well, what is you
what's
know.
What's the meaning of it?
That we spend all our life doing that. We're very good at that.
It makes us really annoying dinner companions.
It does. That's why people don't talk to us.
Well, we have a call from someone who wants to get into a conversation that we had a little while ago. While it's still relatively fresh in our minds, let's bring Sandra from Bridgeton into the discussion. Go ahead, Sandra.
I was just wondering on the Maryville thing, why is it not considered statutory rape? She was 14. My understanding was if you're that far underage, you are legally incapable of giving consent, and no matter what either of them say, it's rape.
Well, actually, that's a good question. The Missouri laws on this topic are very complicated. And if she's 14, but he was 17, and so that does not fall within the definition of statutory rape. If he was over 21, it would. Or if she was 13 or younger, it would. So it's very complex. And then to add to the complexity, the legislature changes it constantly. It's a difficult area. People are often surprised to hear that a 17-year-old can have sex with a 14-year-old and it's not statutory rape, but it's not.
But if two 13-year-olds had sex with each other, consensual sex, that would be statutory rape by both, right?
Yes, it would. And the best way to think of it, it's always illegal to have any kind of sexual contact with someone under 13, and it's usually anything goes over 17. It's that 14 to 17 where it depends on the age of the defendant, how old they reasonably believed the victim to be, issues of intoxication or capacity come into play, and those are all factual issues for juries.
Well, and what about endangering her? If she was dumped off on her front porch in freezing temperatures, she could have died.
Yeah, that's definitely an endangering count. And the prosecutor charged that. And my understanding is that his statement is based on lack of cooperation by the mother and the daughter. He had to drop those charges. And I think that's one of the issues that a special prosecutor will be looking at.
Sandra, thank you so much for the call. You mentioned the legislature, Jennifer. Are you looking for them to revisit the revising the criminal code next time?
I hope they do. Yeah. Our criminal code is in sore need of revision and just ordering and tidying up. And there's been a lot of people, prosecutors, defense attorneys, various individuals working on this project for years and years. And so my hope is that they will finally pass it next legislative session.
Let's take another quick call before our next break. Deb in St. Charles County. Go ahead, Deb.
Hello, can you hear me all right?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to comment on your representative from law enforcement, and I'm sorry, I can't remember her name, but with all due respect, I take issue with her attitude when it comes to the question of police drones. It seemed to me that it was dismissive or almost flippant towards people's genuine and legitimate privacy concerns, and the implication seemed to be that, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, then you shouldn't object to the idea of drones peering into your backyard. And to me, that sounds like a classic Orwellian scenario of how we get to a much more invasive kind of society.
Well, I'm sorry. My name is Jennifer Joyce, and I'm the prosecutor in the city of St. Louis. And you're probably right. I probably did sound a little flippant, and I apologize for that. I've been a prosecutor for 20 years, so I have a lot more comfort level with police, surveillance and things of that nature than most people do. I have to remember that. But I certainly don't think that these drones should be looking into people's houses or in any way going beyond where people have a reasonable expectation of privacy. But right now, the law is that you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in your yard if it's open and it can be seen by an aircraft flying over. And so my point is that is what the law is now, and these drones in no way change that.
Deb, thank you so much for the call. You just heard from Jennifer Joyce, the circuit attorney in the city of St. Louis, a member of our Legal Roundtable panel today. Also with me in studio is Bill Freivogel from SIU in Carbondale and Mark Smith from Washington University. We'll be back to continue this conversation in just a moment. And, of course, we welcome any comments you have and any participation you'd like to have in the program. Give us a call at 382-8255. It's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our Legal Roundtable panel discussion today. About 20,000 retirees from Peabody Energy are very happy folks because they've won a big suit represented by the United Mine Workers of America, $400 million case. Is there anything we need to discuss with regard to that? I mean, this is a big deal. They were the subsidiary of Peabody, Patriot Coal, was established, as some people think, to kind of avoid having to pay retiree benefits to these folks.
I don't think it was a subsidiary. I think it was a spinoff. It's a separate company, right? And that was concerned that they had put stuff over there
to let it go bankrupt.
And so I think the one remaining part of the puzzle is Arch Coal, which was also involved with this. And I've seen conflicting accounts in the press. Some people say no, Arch Coal hasn't joined in any kind of settlement, and still, and then other places it says Arch Coal has. But it seems like Peabody has done theirs. It still needs to be approved by the bankruptcy judge. Judge Surratt states, but assuming she approves it, then part of the agreement is the UAW is not going to be doing any more protests or publications, mm-hmm. and then they also get rid of their stake. They had a 35% stake in Patriot Coal. We were talking, it sounds like it was from an earlier bankruptcy action. I'm not clear on that, but this has got to be a big deal for Peabody. I'm sure this was and for the retirees. They get medical. I think it's only for medical benefits for them.
Right? But can you imagine having all those, whatever benefits lifted from you?
In
a situation like this.
Yeah. I guess.
Any other thoughts?
I guess earlier a bankruptcy judge had said Peabody Holding was not liable, and then an appeals court, Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals panel said it was, and that I guess then led to the ability to settle it.
I tell you, being downtown most of the day in my job, I've been very impressed with the mine workers and how they're here, every month protesting in front of Peabody, and the volume of people that come in for that. I mean, they really, really have put on a strong showing.
Mm-hmm. Another issue we can discuss for a moment concerns the fact that the Supreme Court in Illinois, no date has been set, but we'll hear Governor Quinn's appeal of a lower court ruling over his refusal to pay legislators until they come up with a plan for dealing with the pension crisis they have over there. Bill, I know this is something that caught your eye.
Yeah, I guess I was initially a little surprised the Illinois Supreme Court took it up, because it seems to me so obviously clear that Quinn cannot veto their pay. But I was talking to a couple of legislative aides last week down in Carbondale, and they said they think that the Illinois Supreme Court has agreed to hear this case so they can really make it really clear and knock down Quinn's effort in this case. I mean, there's a part, I think, of the state constitution that says you can't change the pay during a legislative session, just like there's a part of the U.S. Constitution that says that. And, it involves all sorts of kinds of separation of powers kinds of issues. I just think it was just sort of way beyond the power of a governor to do that.
And of course, that particular rule or law is in effect so that legislators can increase their pay primarily.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true. And the other thing that's different, I mean, if I was trying to argue the side I don't agree with, the Quinn side, Illinois does have this weird thing called the amendatory veto. And I think it was the amendatory veto he used to take, which means he can just scratch lines out of bills passed by the legislature, and I guess he crossed out the compensation. It is a different there aren't that many states that have that kind of a provision, and so maybe that gives some substance to Quinn's position, but I have my doubts.
But don't you think this was not really illegal? This was just a political move.
Sure, it's just a political move.
Yeah, it's a populist. I'm going to stick it to the legislators, and I'm not going to accept a paycheck until we get down to the work of government.
Yeah, he's running for re-election, and he's going to have a steep climb to get re-elected. Of course, he did the last time, too.
Well, he just lost some votes there with the legislature.
Is an amendatory veto the same as a line item veto?
Well, I think it essentially is.
It sounds like it.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah. Just it's a horse of a different color,
right?
I guess.
Different name to it.
Okay. We'll backtrack a little bit here. We bring in Fred calling from Glendale on an issue we talked about a couple of minutes ago. Go ahead, Fred.
Hi, Don.
Hi.
Yeah, I was curious. I've got a question. Is the right of privacy mentioned anywhere in our body of law formally, beginning, I guess, with the U.S. Constitution and or our Missouri Constitution?
Well, it's not in the U.S. Constitution, is it?
No, that word is not used in the U.S. Constitution, although the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized some right of privacy. There was a sort of famous statement by Justice Douglas many years ago in a case involving birth control that that the right of privacy is to be found in the penumbra of the Bill of Rights of the Constitution. Now, that's pretty much been ridiculed, I think, but nevertheless, I mean, there's the Fourth Amendment that says you have a right to, be free of unreasonable government searches. That has something to do with privacy. Certainly, there are a lot of legal actions that can be filed you can violate somebody's legal right of privacy.
Roe v. Wade is based on a privacy issue.
Roe v. Wade is based upon an interpretation that, the court there didn't they had sort of like an alternative. They said whether you believe it's part of a woman's right of privacy or whether you think it's protected under the Due Process Clause of the Constitution, we say there's a constitutional right to privacy. So they didn't actually – they were already getting a little bit nervous at that point about Justice Douglas's penumbra of the Bill of Rights.
Only on St. Louis
case law.
Yes, it's case law.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, it's nothing formal in the law.
Well, case law is formal.
Yes. Case law is legal precedent.
Oh, it does.
Mm-hmm.
So our common law system, you have statutes and then you have what judges say, and both are law.
Oh, I'll be darned.
So
I asked the question. I didn't know that.
For example, if a journalist took a secretly recorded the video and audio of a person in their own house, in their own living room, that would violate that person's right of privacy. So there are all sorts of legal actions like that can be brought.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Fred, thanks for the call. You know, we haven't mentioned this with regard to the drones, but there is technology exists today in which a drone theoretically could hover outside your window and listen to the conversation that's going inside. That's getting way ahead of anything that we're hearing about.
Yeah,
in St.
I think
Louis.
That would violate the Fourth Amendment if there wasn't a search warrant for that.
Well, just last term, the U.S. Supreme Court had a decision where they said it would violate the Fourth Amendment to take a drug-sniffing dog up onto the, you know, right outside the front door of a house to sniff if you didn't have a search warrant. So that sounds like it would be a similar kind of—
And the GPS was struck down. GPS. Cops can't just put a GPS on your car.
And I love it when we use words like penumbra on this program, Bill. Thank,
well, thank
you so much
you.
For your
I was looking for penumbra. I wasn't going to come up with it. I was impressed that you had that.
let's take a look at a couple of things going on the national level here. The Supreme Court, we've talked about this before, but the Supreme Court heard the oral arguments with regard to affirmative action at case in Michigan. Any hints during the oral arguments as to what the court was thinking and how this thing might go? It's always dangerous, obviously, to try to predict, but...
Yeah, it is dangerous, and it's a tricky situation because Kagan is recused, so you've got a court that could end up dividing 4-4. I think still the money is on the Michigan constitutional amendment being upheld.
Okay, let's just clarify what that's all about.
So Michigan voters passed a constitutional amendment saying that there couldn't be racial preferences. And so that meant that Michigan Law School and I guess the University of Michigan.
This is just concerning the university.
I'd have to go back and double check, but I think it's beyond the university. It was generated by the Michigan, by University of Michigan's affirmative action plans, but I think it would apply more broadly than just to university, to the university. But okay, so Michigan, University of Michigan, and particularly the Michigan Law School had in place an affirmative action plan, a narrow affirmative action plan that gave some preference to on the basis of race. It was upheld. The law school's plan was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. I think that was 2003. A couple years later, maybe it was 2006, the Michigan voters said, we are not going to permit any racial preferences. And so the question is, before the U.S. Supreme Court, is that permissible? Or does it involve a political restructuring of government that puts...
An extra burden on
minorities to get the university to give them some sort of a preference. And so the argument, I think still that probably the majority, the more conservative majority of the court will prevail, and that and they will uphold that Michigan constitutional provision and say there can't be affirmative action. The one thing that causes a little bit of hesitation is that apparently all through the argument, Justice Kennedy, who was trying to explore the reach of this political restructuring argument. And so, I mean, one of the cases that it was involved in was where Washington voters said that the state could not have mandatory transportation of students for desegregation purposes. This was back in the 80s. And the U.S. Supreme Court said that constitutional amendment violated the U.S. Constitution because it involved a restructuring of government in a way that put minorities at a disadvantage. And so Justice Kennedy clearly was trying to figure out, how are the facts in Michigan different from the facts in Washington, or do I, if I'm going to stick with the Washington decision, do I have to throw out this Michigan referendum?
So once again, Kennedy probably holds the key to this.
I think so. This
whole thing. Another issue that is getting some attention is the Department of Justice is suing the state of North Carolina in connection with its voting rights law. By the way, I have here Tennessee Supreme Court upheld that state's voter ID law on, coincidentally, last Friday. But again, what's going on here with the Department of Justice? They're claiming that the North Carolina law is discriminatory.
Right. This is a second sort of follow-up to the U.S. Supreme Court decision last June, which threw out a portion of the Voting Rights Act. And so the North Carolina case follows upon a similar case in Texas, where the Justice Department is saying is using something called the I think it's called the bail-in provision of the Voting Rights Act, which says that if we that the Justice Department or a judge can require jurisdictions with a history of discrimination to get approval for voting changes. And the Justice Department is saying that the changes in North Carolina were purposeful discrimination to put African Americans in a worse position. They also – not only do they have the voter ID in North Carolina, but there's also – they got rid of the 7-day in advance voting, which had been used quite a bit by African Americans. They also got rid of, I think, provisional balloting.
Right. If you go to the wrong poll, it still counts. Right. And so it's interesting. So now the government has to prove discrimination, where before that Supreme Court decision, the state had approved they weren't discriminating. And I think in Texas they found some, because Texas has a similar type of situation, they found some kind of emails among some of the state legislatures that seem anti-Hispanic. So that may provide their intent. But I think – and also they have to prove it was biased against a particular race rather than just biased against Democrats. So it's not enough to say they were intentionally trying to hurt the Democrats.
I wonder how long this is likely to play out in court before we get some sort of a
– I think it'll be a while because you're getting lots of these kinds of cases coming up.
Yeah.
The issue of privacy has gotten a response from a number of our listeners here today. Let's respond to this tweet from Tony, who says, "So if I erect privacy fences around my yard, I don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy?" Jennifer?
It's my understanding of the law, and I defer to these scholarly gentlemen, that from the aerial perspective, you don't.
Well, they are scholarly because they used the word penumbra a little while ago.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's correct. I know there was a U.S. Supreme Court decision right on this point of aerial surveillance that picks up like growing of marijuana, and I'd have to go back and read it. But certainly on the public street, and if you get away from yards, on the public street, there is no expectation of privacy. Hence, all these cameras that are on street corners and drones that might go down in public streets. There's no expectation of privacy that people have there.
So if you're growing marijuana plants in your backyard, you probably need to put something over them.
Put a tarp.
Yeah, a tarp, something that lets the sunlight through.
It's
the only time we've given legal advice.
It's interesting that most of the conversation that we've had coming at us from the audience deals with the privacy issue. There seems to be some concern
because
about
that. I think people are worried about this because technology is changing. Like we said, the Supreme Court had a couple of cases, drug-sniffing dogs. I guess that's not a new technology, but mm-hmm. this GPS device that we were talking about.
Well, and there's the whole Snowden and the, all of that and, the government looking at everybody's emails and cell phone records. And I think the general mood of the public is one of concern about this, and drones make people nervous.
I think that's good. And people, we shouldn't just accept everything. I don't think it's terrible, but I think it's good to have people talking about it, thinking about it, and maybe raising issues.
Absolutely.
Jennifer, I think you hit the nail on the head and you said the D word. People seeing what's going on overseas and the fact that a lot of people are being killed by these things has them particularly apprehensive. Well, that brings us to the end of our discussion for today. I want to thank you all once again for being with us for our Legal Roundtable. Jennifer Joyce, always good to have you with us.
Thanks
very much for being here. Bill Freivogel, good to see you again, and thank you for being with us. Sometime we'll have to get together and talk about your recent trip to China. And Mark Smith, thank you so much for being with us and representing Washington University so well, as you always do. Yeah. And tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at a new book examining the country around the 100 miles or so of the Missouri River from Herman to the confluence with the Mississippi. It's called St. Louis's Backyard, that 100-mile stretch along the Missouri River. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.